Let's jump in, though, to the headline issue from, say, the RTE Investigates programme. And it's what struck a chord with everybody, and it's what made a lot of people, I think, stop and say, this is unacceptable. This can't continue, and how has this been happening? And this was the report commissioned by your own board, which you didn't choose to publish and you didn't give to the Dáil. I think you cited commercial reasons. And then, according to the RTE programme, when it became apparent they had it and were producing this documentary, it was then that you published it. So there was a sense of a lack of transparency there. But the headline figure, 16,000 greyhounds bred every year in Ireland, and we are overbreeding. We are probably the capital worldwide when it comes to overbreeding. So of those 16,000 per year, 6,000 are culled or disappear, frankly. So that's 16 per day, 115 dogs per week. There's a line on the below-cost dumping of dogs in the UK in that same report, and it says the below-cost dumping of dogs in the UK is ultimately underpinned by Irish taxpayer money, which is a stark line, I think. So the cost dumping of dogs in the UK is ultimately underpinned by Irish taxpayer money. And what this report said as well, and it cost, I think, about 100 grand, it talked about pup control as being out of control, the overbreeding. From an animal rights perspective, this issue, quote, could threaten the very existence of the industry. Again, this was the report that you commissioned and the RTE Investigates programme got hold of. I know traceability is improving, and I'll give you a chance to talk about that. However, $250 million given to the industry over the last 20 years. How did this situation continue? How did we get to a point where 6,000 were being culled every year?
Okay, there's a lot covered there, Joe, in terms of what you said and what Holly has said, and maybe to try to take issues one by one.
Yeah, let's go overbreeding. Overbreeding. This is a kernel issue, because this 6,000 dogs a year, the Irish taxpayer can't stand over that. So let's get into that one.
I've got to admit, I've shed a few tears when I sent and said it was over. But, all good things come to an end. I've had a great time. Don't feel sorry for me, because I've still got a lot of things to look forward to and still a lot to do.
And were you oscillating back and forth when you made the decision and sent the tweet, or were you in a fairly definite place mentally?
No, I knew it was time. Okay. I knew it was time. I think I always knew that, I'd know when the time was right, and when I had a couple of scares, when the crowds went from darts, it just seemed like the perfect time to just say, I'll go out on a high, go out when the going's good, and not get that tap on the shoulder or whatever, and just go out on my terms, which is a real privilege in this. But you know, so many people in our industry get the elbow, don't complain about it, or whatever, and it's perfect. It was perfect in every way. Mm. So. And as I say, I still want to. I've raised over £500,000 for Parkinson's research now, which is, that'll be my legacy, as well as presenting live sport. But hell of a ride, brilliant fun.
No, hell of a ride. Most people don't do 22 years at a place, place like Sky, working at the level you're doing. I mean, that's a brilliant career under any circumstances. I'm not surprised that 39-year-old used you as an example, and a brilliant example at that, of how you can cope and still manage to live a very full life, even in the midst of a serious weight on your shoulders. And it is a serious weight, there's no two ways about that. And you can empathise, you know how difficult it is to tell people and to transform from a normal run-of-the-mill into, to some degree or other, unfortunately, defined a little bit by your disease. That's a tough line to cross, there's no going back for people when they do it.
It's why I kept it a secret for 2.5 years.
Yeah.
It was really hard. I didn't tell anybody. And I was doing a boxing show in Liverpool, and the on-air clock was ticking down, and I was trying to do my tie-up, put my cufflinks on, and I was really struggling. Couldn't do it. And I thought, I can't ask anyone for help. And I was actually hiding in a cupboard. It seems ridiculous now, but hiding in a cupboard, doing my tie-up, trying to get my cufflinks on, and I had an earpiece on, and they were saying, Clarky, Time to come now. Where is he? And it was really stressful, and that affected me for days afterwards. And I thought, after that, I've really got to tell people. And very supportive. Little things that my production team at Sky did to help me were amazing. Just things like something so simple. My right hand doesn't work very well, so when I was doing interviews, my hand might shake, and it just distracts from the interview. So they did like a face mounted mic for me, like a Madonna face mounted mic. So I got on stage with a mic on my face, and I didn't have to use my hands. The players would hold a microphone, and it was just a little thing, little alteration rather than abandonment. Just little alterations like that helped me along the way, and I'm really proud of what I've achieved.
Mm. So I suspect you never regretted going public with it or having it define you in some way, or was that difficult as well?
It was hard, you know. I didn't want people to feel sorry for me.
Or having it define you in some way, or was that difficult as well?
It was hard, you know. I didn't want people to feel sorry for me.
Yeah.
I didn't want people to see me as the bloke with Parkinson's. Now it's turned into a good thing because people appreciate what I've done, and being a positive role model for people with Parkinson's. I've shown people it's not the end when you've got Parkinson's. You know, I admit when I was diagnosed, I was googling bungalows and wheelchairs and all that sort of stuff, and I can still get the stairs easily. I can still walk with a limp. Sometimes when I'm bad, I can't do the buttons on my shirt. I can't write my name, and my speech is slurred, and I feel really flat. But if you've got Parkinson's, get up, get dressed, get out. You know, and the good days after a bad day will come a good day. So if you've got Parkinson's, don't give up. Keep fighting.
Where does fear come into it, Dave?
Fear?
Yeah.
I live in the moment. I don't think too much about the future, because if I thought about the future for me is not bright, because eventually I won't be able to walk, I won't be able to talk, I won't be able to smile, and that's the inevitability of Parkinson's. You know, it was discovered 200 years ago. The medicine I'm using is over 50 years old. It's the same medicine my dad was on, levodopa. It's good, but we can do better, you know. Harold Wilson was Prime Minister. Man hadn't landed on the moon, was still using the same medication. And it just masks the symptoms. It hides the symptoms. It doesn't cure anything. So without it, I'm a mess. And, the fear is that in the future, I won't be able to walk and talk and be wheelchair-bound. And eventually, most people with Parkinson's, end-stage Parkinson's, choke to death because they can't swallow. So it's a horrible ending, but I don't think about that. Whenever I start thinking about that, I change my thought process, eliminate it straight away. Think about sunshine and sunflowers and a positive outlook. You look into the future, it's not bright. So.
Okay, because I guess there might be different approaches there. There's the one you're taking, which is definitely working for you. Other people might want to face that reality and maybe speak with a counsellor or write it all down and sit with it for a while, and maybe that works for them, maybe it doesn't. I frankly don't know what the hell I would do.
Car was totaled. They had to replace the whole vehicle because the acid got inside the car, inside the material, inside into the engine and everything. And again, we have video cameras along here, so you saw two guys walking up to the car nonchalantly, have whatever bottle that's in, and the two of them walk all the way around the car about twice, nonchalantly, hoods up, and then walk off again. You know, and like those things, like it's scary. That's not just words. That's, you know, and that's my family. It's my home. Mm-hmm. People know where I live, you know, and that has been tough. But again, like the support from the community and people of Ireland has been amazing, and it has given me the strength, you know, to keep going. Yeah, I think in the face of adversity and things like that, in the past, sure, what change would there ever have been in the world if because, you know, it got tough, we stopped.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you draw a line from the egging and the graffiti and the acid? That's connected to you speaking up as part of the Black Lives Matter movement last year. Is that that's when all this kind of kicked off, is it?
Yeah, it all started when I was doing a lot of activist work. I was, you know, on our local radio station, in the local newspaper, in the Irish Times, and, you know, on the Tuberty Show. I was doing takeovers on Instagram pages, like, of quite high profile people. So it was a means to kind of shut me up, I think, but it did the opposite. And gave me a fire instead.
Do you find when you walk down the street, you think to yourself, I wonder, is that a commenter? I wonder, is he or she a commenter? Like, I would feel that if I was walking down the street and I know that most people are good, but there's plenty out there who are not. I would, you know, you catch people's eyes in the street all the time. You don't know what they're thinking. I think if I was you, I would wonder, is that dude looking at me thinking that you should go home?
I definitely have a couple of times. So I try not to, like...
Because you could go paranoid with that.
Yeah, you could. So, you know what I mean? And that's the thing. Like, I've always tried to live my life in a positive way and focus on the blessings that I have rather than the negatives. Because I think if I had, I would be a very, very angry person. Yeah. I would have a lot of hate inside me, a lot of anger, and I'd be miserable. But if I allowed that to happen, sure, that means they've won, you know? And I have a beautiful family. I've... a lovely mum, I've a beautiful husband and kids, like I love my job, I love the work I do, I have a great life. So for me, I focus on those positive things, you know, as best I can. I'm human at the end of the day too, and there are bad days, but for the most part, you know.
Yeah, and God, I'm not, I was going to say I'm afraid to ask. And is the N-word still a part of your world? Is that in Ireland 2021, is that still surfacing?
Oh, Yeah. And most nights that I would ever go out to socialize, that's a word I'll hear.
You're joking.
Whether somebody just walking past me, or they're behind me, or they're having a conversation. Like I've been in watching a football match, and a guy, I'm about a meter away from him, and he was talking about the football players and calling them the F word monkeys, and, you know, damn N words. And I'm just sitting there trying to enjoy myself, you know, and I'm just horrendous. I also had a person get their change from their drink and turn and look at me and then back to the barman and said, yeah, you can put that in the box for the black babies.
Like, where do you start? What do you do?
Yeah.
Of all the things I wanted to talk to you about, this is the most important one. Your great legacy is the smoking ban, in many ways. Yeah. The whole, you know, just a phenomenal thing to have done. This is where you can make such a huge difference, because it falls along socioeconomic lines as well. I mean, the wealthy families, their kids are in training. It's the underprivileged areas where this is becoming a bigger issue. 2013, France. I know they have a longer school day and longer school year, but you'll take the point. France, 108 hours per year PE. Austria, 102 hours per year PE. Portugal, 90 hours. I'll skip the rest. Ireland, 37 hours per year. Fourth worst in Europe.
Yeah, that's not good enough.
It's a time bomb. Yeah, it's like you're talking about priorities and we've got to sort this out and, you know, you've got to take something out. We have to take things out to stop this situation continuing as it is. Where are we going to be in a decade?
But we also have to bring in more structured PE, you know, in terms of the way the primary cycle develops. Mm-hmm. You have the one master teacher, if you like.
Well, could I suggest a simple-ish solution that you could, in 3, 4, 5 years, we could be up and running with this. Have a designated PE teacher for one school or two or three schools, like the GAA officer goes around. I mean, you could train them, get them out the door within 2-3 years.
That's what I was coming to. Yeah. I think you're going to need that at primary level. To get the buy-in of schools and to get the consistency in schools on a year-to-year basis, and not just be depending on the one teacher. If that teacher moves on or that teacher moves to a different area, then it falls down.
Yes.
So you will need that structured kind of PE input at primary level and additional hours as well to get the kind of to up our performance in respect of that. And I think one of the great negatives of our performance has been our focus on the sports thing side of PE and on the game, so to speak, to the neglect of the wider aspects of physical development, fitness, linked into nutrition and well-being. I've met Neil Moyner, I've discussed this with him, particularly at second level, and his ideas around that and education more generally. His view, I think, he had a view generally that you should combine it into a sort of a sports science or type of program at second level, for example, where you combine a number of disciplines in terms of people's appreciations of the multidisciplinary nature of a lot of this. But at primary level, I get your point.
Yeah. And teachers, this is an attack on teachers, they text in and say, have you seen our curriculum? Do you think we can fit everything in? So I get that.
But I'm not so sure we all do that, because I'm in the Dáil a lot. I've been in the Dáil for quite a number of years now. And invariably someone will stand up and say, I think the schools should do the following. But on physical education, I take your point. It's not an extra. It's a core part of our everyday lives. It's a core part of who we should be. And
So give us the commitment. Genuinely, give us.
I'm not going to say something off the top of my head here.
Because
it's easy to say it here.
Yeah.
I know how this works. This has to go through the curriculum body. It has to get.
Now we're getting to it.
But you have
now
to get buy-in from.
And so why can't we get buy-in to this?
It needs to be integrated, as we said, in terms of teacher allocation, in terms of developing a new qualification for primary, whereby you would have a cohort of primary PE. Teachers who, as you suggested, would either be shared between schools or smaller schools in rural Ireland, or for example one per school.
But wouldn't you agree, very solvable, very doable?
Well, it is doable.
So the frustration
here
is,
for example, we didn't do it quite like this, but we did science. I can recall we didn't have science in a formal way on the curriculum.
Right.
I brought in the last primary school curriculum back in 1999,
And
therefore, that was a radical curriculum in its
day. I'm sure it was.
It brought science in. For the first time, it gave a structured timeline to PE. Up to then, it didn't have it.
Yeah.
We're now 2020.
Yeah, and it's commendable when you brought it in, but we're so behind. So what are we saying here? You're saying, what's going to happen now? If we talk in 4 or 5 years, I mean, I know there's problems and you have to get it through and you have to do this and you have to get buy-in, but like, people don't want to hear that. You agree it's a no-brainer. I agree it's a no-brainer. Everyone agrees it's a no-brainer.
It needs to be adopted as government policy. You need to put in place then the mechanisms to achieve it, on both the personnel front, getting the people trained, and so forth, and then actually reorganizing your curriculum, which you're going to have to do, and that can be done, but it's not done just by one announcement. But I think we can show leadership in that regard and say we're going to do it, and then set and train the modus operandi for doing it and the how of getting it done.
And why hasn't that happened already?
Well, it hasn't happened already because I think, as I said to you earlier, your progress is made on a gradual basis. I think that what that teacher said to you, it's one of the most difficult challenges in education is dividing up that school day.
Mm.
And it's a short, when I say short, I mean we have a number of objectives ranging from science right across to, for example, CSPE. In terms of the health and mental well-being of students, we want schools to do well-being classes. We want schools to do more on mental health, and likewise, you have the core subjects then, in terms of the maths, the English, the Irish, the geography, the history, and then the science curriculum, which has been a big innovation.
Mm.
And so, for example, we would have brought back in the late 90s a pilot program in modern languages, which was done after school.
I'm not saying great things haven't been done.
What I'm trying to say to you is that the school day only allows for so much.
I know.
So that's the real kernel of the issue.
I accept
dividing
that.
Up
and
your primary school
we're agreed
day
this is so important. Yeah. So tell me how this works then, because I'm politics better than me. You're saying you're using words like mechanisms in place and do this.
No, basically, if you're a Minister for Education and this is something you want to do, you have to work with the education training colleges to say, okay, we want a certain cohort of teachers coming out of your colleges that are
able to
qualified to teach.
And how quickly can that happen in theory?
Qualified to teach primary children.
Yes. How quickly?
Big difference to post-primary. You're talking about really, and it would be a degree qualification. That's 3 to 4 years.
Great.
Just to get the qualification going. You could adapt to current programs that are in place in some of the colleges.
Even three, four, 5 years is a great result. I mean, in the lifetime of a state, it's the blink of an eye.
That's in the personnel, the teachers, right? The next part, then, you'd have to do a curriculum piece.
That can be done during the 3-4 years of training the teachers. There's no reason why in five years this can't be done.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it can be done. I'm not disputing
that. And who's going to do it?
Government will have to do it, and ministers will have to lead in respect of it. Then you ask the question, how does it get done? That's how it gets done.
So there's no reason why in 5 years, which is the blink of an eye in terms of the lifetime of a state, it is a failure.
Have a specific provision for PE. Yes, you could have.
And it doesn't have to be every day. We can get up to 3, 4, 5 hours. That's a 5-fold increase. I just don't...
You could, very quickly.
Okay.
Not disagreeing with you.
Right. So can I trust that you're going to get on it then?
I get on it. Yeah.
Okay. We'll have a chat in 5 years.
Sooner, before that.
Okay.